Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 51, recorded on January 24th, 2011. The Evolution of Music. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free 14-day trial, go to squarespace.com/htg. And by MailRoute, a secure hosted service that filters viruses and spam for companies of any size. Visit mailroute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Leo and Tom use. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Robert Rich, an electronic music composer that several listeners have requested to be a guest on the show, so I'm really happy to have him here. Hey, Robert, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm honored.
I sure do appreciate you being here. We've got a lot of interesting things to talk about, but I'd like to start by reminding those who are tuned into the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Robert, and I'll pass on as many as I can. Speaking of which, let me get my chat room working here so that I can see it. Hi, everybody in the chat room. So, Robert, we've known each other for about 25 years now. I was thinking back, and over all that time, I'd love to hear what you think about how the technology of electronic music has changed over that time.
Well, I think that we're actually stumbling into a problem of everything being so easy that it's hard to know what to do.
A plethora of choices. Yes, the abundance of choices, huh?
Yeah, I always found that one of the worst things for my creativity was to be able to do anything that I ever thought of. I always felt that there was a value to limitations, and that having tools that prevented me from doing things actually kept me doing interesting things. Now, you pretty much, open up the software on your computer and you immediately have a perfectly synchronized, very, very good sounding, infinite tracks. There's really very few limitations that I would have been hampered by, 20 years ago. It's almost scary to me. I have a much harder time coming up with good ideas than I do figuring out how to do them once I think of them.
Yeah, I faced the same thing myself in my musical career when I was doing more in my own studio, the same exact thing. There's like an infinity before you, or in the case of writing, a blank piece of paper or blank computer screen, really, for me. And, you can do anything you want. How do you narrow those choices? Have you found any technique or any way of thinking about it that, in fact, does allow you to narrow your focus to a point where you can get something done?
I used the same techniques that I think I developed a long time ago, and that was to create a conceptual unity within a piece of work before I could really start it. There's a strange creative process whereby a piece of work really can't take shape until it starts forming itself like a homunculus in your mind. Really, it becomes a golem, like a living thing in your consciousness. And that process that I think creative people learn pretty early, to try to nurture these living entities in them, that process, becomes very, very useful in a time when so many things are possible. What you have to do is limit the questions so that the why question is really the most interesting one. And then after you've limited things to a certain set of question marks, then things start making themselves happen, It's a little bit just a habit of working, I guess, to look for areas that are interesting or a theme to ask yourself. I remember this first struck me back when I was in college and I was trying to make stuff with my, trying to make music with my rather cheesy home-built Paya modular system. Mm-hmm. And had several albums done by the time I was about a junior in college. And then, you know, this was Shunyata, Trances and Drones, and a live album that had come out in Sweden. And I managed to get in as an undergraduate to CCRMA at Stanford, the Computer Music Center there. And suddenly I was faced with this absolutely horrifying blank slate, which was the computer screen and a very powerful, for the time, 250 oscillator computer synthesizer. But you had to start from scratch. You had to build all of your own voices with line code using, you know, the Stanford Artificial Intelligence language. And it was daunting. I found myself faced with this problem of infinite choices and no template, nothing to start from, nothing to recommend one choice over another. And I got almost no interesting music done there. I did a few stochastic things with voice synthesis, and probably the most useful thing I did at the time was come up with a whole bunch of microtonal frequency references, which it was such a waste of the Samson box. It was, you know, I was in there at about 4 a.m. so that I could get a consistent, like, you know, 30 or 40 minutes of synthesis time. And I had created some code to generate exact frequencies based upon a matrix of pitches that I'd worked out, some of which had come from the back of a book. And I was just a beginner at microtonal stuff. This was actually how you and I got to know each other, is through the Just Intonation scene in the early days of trying to get synthesizers tunable.
Right.
But I used those pitch references, which I recorded onto a half-track, quarter-inch tape. You know, I'd play that tape on my Revox and use it to tune my Prophet 5. And those things probably were the most useful thing I did at Karma. But the irony was that you could do electronic or computer music there far more sophisticated than what I was able to do on a couple keyboards. But I ended up getting a lot more interesting work done with a couple keyboards. And I think that's just because of the limitations they offered.
Well, there was also the issue, though, of having to, as you say, input code line by line to get any sound out of it. Whereas even the early synthesizers, you could fiddle with knobs and find interesting sounds that might inspire an entire piece. I remember that happening to me on occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. I always found myself working from improvisation first, and that helps me to form ideas. I'll spend a lot of time just, you know, doing the sonic equivalent of throwing paint onto a canvas with my eyes closed, you know? And then sometimes a form takes shape. There's actually, you know, I think in surrealist movement, there was a tendency for this kind of automatic writing to start. You know, Max Ernst was a really good example of somebody whose paintings would come. You know, he would mix oil paints and water paints together and drip them down a canvas, flip it upside down, and suddenly he would start seeing things in it, and it would become a painting. Mm-hmm. I think that I often use the sonic equivalent of that, where I'll get set up some microphones and scrape things and hit things and put them into some computer processing and time stretch them. And before I know it, I'm starting to build a piece, even if I didn't really know what it was going to be at first. Mm. But the...
I had the thought that it comes full circle in a way that when you were at Karma at Stanford, you were working almost entirely on a computer screen, if I'm not mistaken, as I recall being there that long ago. Then then you came home and you had a couple of keyboards, and now you have a bunch more keyboards. I see in the back of your in your background there in your studio, you have a modular synthesizer, a lot of hardware. And now it has come back to software synthesizers in the computer and sequencers, and you can do, once again, everything in the computer, although it's quite a bit different. You don't have to write lines of code anymore.
That certainly makes it easier not having to start from scratch like that. The tools are certainly a lot more easy to use. I still find hardware to be a good place to start with for inspiration. Often I'll begin with something clocked on the modular synth and delays and things happening, not in the computer, but actually in hardware, like with some Eventides and things like that, and get a feeling of something going that's actually in the room live with me. And then I'll just record stuff onto the hard disk and chop and start building a piece out of it. This sounds rather different from what I was saying at the beginning, where it helps me to start with a question and to form something in my mind. It sounds like now what I'm saying is I just improvise until something forms and then I chop it up and make a piece out of it.
Well, really both approaches are valid, I think.
Well, they work into each other, too. Often it's very difficult for me to do something interesting improvisationally until I have a context that I'm working towards. If there's something sonically, for example, just a name of an album that I think creates a theme, it maybe seems very old world, you know, old school 1970s prog rock or something to have a concept album all the time. And it's not a concept in the sense of telling a story or some kind of an opera. Sometimes it's just a very loose theme. My last album, Elong, was loosely based on the idea of fragrance and scent being one of the other sense modalities that we can use as a metaphor. And that was coming from this realization that I've had over the years as a mastering engineer, that I actually, the metaphor for me when I'm experiencing sound is actually more tactile than it is sonic. Mm. And that I end up using tactile words to describe the way sound feels to me. So it'll be scratchy or velvety or smooth. Mm. These words to be the first things that come out of my mind when I'm trying to describe the indescribable. Often when I'm trying to figure out what an album needs to sound better, that I'm mastering, I feel it on my skin almost more than I do in my ears. And so that is part of this realization that we're using all of our sense modalities for all arts. And it's not that I'm, you know, Scriabin, you know, seeing my smells and all of this, but right. I do feel that in the sensorium of the mind, there's a place where all of these sense modalities merge and where art becomes a gestalt, a pure form of expression mm-hmm. and of experience. So when I'm smelling something, I often also will feel it as a tactile thing, or, you know, I'm a winemaker, a lover of good wine, and I find that the complexity of fragrances in wine fascinates me because it's so infinite, it's so deep. And the vocabulary that we can use to describe all this range of fragrance ends up merging not so much into the vocabulary of flavor, which, of course, fragrance and flavor are always combined, but into a tactile vocabularies as well. And so that's what I mean when I'm saying that sometimes a question has to form to create an album, for me to be able to start an album, you know, to give myself permission to eliminate 99% of the choices that I have in front of me and to focus on just one or two choices. You know, I was stuck after being on tour last year. I was on the road for about 2.5 months and then had a break of a couple weeks and then went off to Portugal for a big festival. Got back in around the end of August, early September. And then I was teaching a college class on mastering for the next 5 months. And that the whole thing sort of just shut down my creative instincts. I had almost no fresh ideas for a long time. Plus, I had a lot of mastering jobs waiting. Mm. And that felt like a real dead spot. It felt like there was nothing really that I had creative left. You know, sometimes you just feel wrung out, dry like a sponge.
Sure.
And then I started working in December on some new thoughts. I had in my head the idea that I was going to make a dub album, which, funny enough, was what I had thought Elong was going to be like as well. Kind of rhythmic.
It didn't
with
turn
bass.
Out that way?
No. It ended up becoming more Carnatic South Indian influence, which just because that was the people that I met that were willing to play on the album, and it just took on that kind of energy. Indian music is a big influence for me, so that made a lot of sense. And Carnatic music was a fresh inspiration because I'd mostly been exposed to Northern Indian, and so the idea that some of these pieces of music that people were playing were 2,000 years old, and that it was a continued transmission, it's a little bit more formal of a transition than, formal of a tradition mm-hmm. than North Indian music, which is more up for interpretation and is probably, with the Mughal tradition, probably only 200 or 300 years old. The Carnatic tradition really goes back to the Upanishads and to the Rig Vedas. It's astonishingly deep.
Yeah,
and so that
it's beautiful.
That whole inspiration took over the album and it kind of co-opted it.
Just for everybody's information, before we go on, Scriabin, you mentioned earlier, is Alexander Scriabin, a 19th century Russian composer who... I don't think I would say suffered from a condition, but had a condition called synesthesia, in which the input from one sense is perceived by a different sense. So, for example, he might hear sounds and smell something, or see something and taste it by visual input. And he was famous for creating color organs with his music, and even went so far as to do smell-o-vision, in a sense, of wafting scents into the auditorium as his music was playing. It was really quite astonishing.
Well, and like some synesthesiacs, he assumed that what he was experiencing in his mind was sort of a universal experience, and that he could, you know, write a chord that was purple. And I think they've come to realize that with synesthesia, there are certain common modalities that feel similar between many synesthesiacs. So like some people, when they hear speech, will, think in terms of color, but certain sounds in speech will usually trigger similar colors in people, like the sound, you know, the sibilant sound of S. Mm-hmm. Often is blue for synesthesiacs for some reason. And that's, I think, because there are certain universals within human consciousness. Mm-hmm. We're all basically, you know, monkeys in our skin. And the
I do have a question from there. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Question.
I was going to say, I have a question in the chat room. Stephen3X asks if you've ever met Brian Eno, Thomas Dolby, or Wendy Carlos. Any of those electronic musicians, have you ever met them or worked with them?
I have met Brian Eno briefly. We were introduced after he gave a talk in San Francisco, probably 12, 13 years ago. And he was a gentleman. I have gotten to know his brother a lot better. Roger Eno was on tour with Redelius about 10 years ago, and they both came by our house. My wife and I hosted them for an evening, and that was a lot of fun. Akim Redelius is more of a friend. I've, you know, had his family stay with us several times. In fact, I'm currently mastering an old album of Redelius's. But Brian, you know, he's in demand a lot, and I haven't quite gotten a chance to get to know him. We know who each other is, obviously. He's heard my music. Thomas Dolby lives in the Bay Area, and he's been involved with high tech quite a bit around here. And
for a long time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And two nerdy looking bald guys with glasses. Sometimes we've been mistaken, or I've been mistaken for him once or twice. I think maybe 10 years ago I looked a little more like him. But we haven't met personally, although I have friends who've worked for him. And Wendy Carlos, I have never had the chance to meet. Our circles don't cross, our paths don't cross very much.
Right.
However, great respect for all three. And one thing that's, I think, common with electronic music and the musicians that make this, you know, strange kind of introspective music is that we all tend to get along pretty well, and a lot of us know each other. It's a pretty small scene.
Mm-hmm. It's much like the scene I inhabit, which are tuba players. Believe it or
yes.
not. And we all know each other. And we all get along very well. It's the brotherhood of the tuba, and it works very well. I wanted to also touch upon not only how music technology has changed over the last 25 years, but how music is enjoyed. You and I have talked about this before, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it on the podcast. How people are consuming music these days? How has it changed over the last 2.5, 3 decades?
Well, I mean, most of that change, I think, has happened in the last decade. And we have the iPod to thank for that and the amazing user interface that Apple created to really change the way people consume and purchase music. Although I think it really started happening in the late 90s when Napster opened up the doors for the idea of free music and MP3s. I think most recording artists of my generation started noticing that within about 3 or 4 weeks after the release of an album, people could find it on Russian bootleg sites, you know, for free.
Mm-hmm.
And that has certainly changed the way people expect music to be found or used, consumed. I think that it's an interesting artifact of a materialistic culture that we think of music in terms of consumption. I'm, of course, you know, a generation where, you know, you and I grew up when the recording industry was maturing into rock and roll and became a huge industry for a period of time. Perhaps that's a blip in history. I'm not sure if we're going to see that that's the case in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting since I am a mastering engineer and I get a lot of work that comes through, people wanting to have their music heard and they want it to sound as good as possible. And with the students that I teach at Cogswell College, I get to see a little bit of what the 20-year-olds and 25-year-olds are expecting to experience out of their own music-making urge. And I feel that the expectations have been shifting with the generation. And these days, people are expecting music to be serving picture more so than as a standalone experience.
Mm.
I think most 25-year-olds that I've met look at the standalone listening of music, you know, listening to music only, kind of wistfully. They look back on it as a kind of thing from their childhood, stuff their parents used to do.
How quaint.
Yeah, it's kind of quaint. You know, maybe the way that that my generation would have looked at the great era of jazz. You know, I think of the great Miles Davis albums, you know, which mostly came out around the years that I was born.
Mm.
And I think, oh, if only jazz could be like that again, you know, where people are really at the edge of experimenting and where everything felt new. People in their 20s now, I think they look at the experience of flipping a record over after 20 minutes of sitting down and reading the cover on your couch in front of speakers as a sort of cute thing that their parents might still do from time to time, but probably not because they're too busy.
And but we also have audiophiles, though. The Stereophile magazine, for example, which is also part of the group I work for, you know, is dedicated to the act of sitting down in front of a pair of speakers and listening to music, which I think by and large the greater population tends not to do anymore. It's more music is more for background while you're cleaning or driving or, you know, something like that.
Exactly. And I would venture to guess, and I haven't done major statistics about this, so I could be proven wrong, that the audiophile demographic is made up predominantly of baby boomer males, which would describe you and me.
Yes, indeed. And
I think that that is, as I said, perhaps a blip in history. I think that there are other people who fit the demographic or other people who are audiophiles who don't fit that. I know that there's a huge movement towards headphone audiophile experience. There's the HeadFi forum, for example. I have a very good friend who's very active in that, and he brings all these headphones for me to listen to and to compare to my mastering monitors. And the mobile listening experience has certainly come to dominate the static, stable listening experience, the listening room.
Mm-hmm.
I think that with internet downloads becoming the norm for listening to music, we have to still transition into a period where people are listening to uncompressed audio to full resolution. I'm a throwback because I still like to buy compact discs merely so that I have the full resolution files nearby. I rip them into iTunes at 16-bit 44.1. Mm-hmm. And I prefer to have the uncompressed audio. I mean, I'm a bit strange that way. I rip through large quantities of hard disk space. but that's because I just don't like the sort of shut down, closed, cold sound of MP3s. They get pretty good at the 256-bit rate, but there's still something frustrating about them. In my class, I do a little experiment early in the semester where I show the students how to do a 90-degree phase inversion of a waveform and then sum up the two files and see what's different between one file and another, you know, to do a subtraction. And the experiment is to get uncompressed digital audio and a 192 MP3, invert one of them, line them up exactly in phase, and listen to what's different. It's astonishing how much is missing from that MP3. There's what's left over when you subtract the two is high and low frequency information in particular, and a lot of out-of-phase information, the soundstage, the depth, the sense of ambience is missing. So what you feel, here I am using tactile words again, as I say.
Go for it, man.
What I feel is missing, and what I can hear when I do a subtraction test, is the depth in the audio, that sense of immersion. And that's one of the things that audiophiles spend a lot of money trying to regain with, you know, good recordings and trying to basically feel the depth of the audio, to immerse themselves into it. It's why with digital audio, we spend a lot of money on good clocks so that we reduce jitter. The effects of jitter on an audio recording is to flatten it, is to create a kind of coldness. And that's exactly what MP3s do. So one of the important things, I think, as we look at the way people listen to music, I hate the word consume music because it implies this sort of disposable commodity, which is becoming more and more the assumption, I think. But the way people listen to music becomes more disposable, I think, in part because they are listening more and more to fatiguing audio, compressed audio, and also over limited audio. I'm using the word compression in the first sense is data compression, like MP3, but also compression in the sense of lacking dynamics. We're listening to more compressed music with less dynamic range now than we have in the entire history of human hearing. And I mean that in a very literal sense, that when we listen to modern recordings, they're mastered sometimes with a dynamic range of less than 6 decibels from peak to average, what we call a crest factor. Mm-hmm. And when we have a crest factor less than about like 12 dB, we start getting a fatiguing experience, something that is destroying the fabric of the music and making it far less enjoyable. It becomes tiresome. I think
This is true even of CDs, uncompressed music, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, when we need to be careful with the word data compression versus dynamic
compression. Range compression, right?
And we have this dual problem right now, is that we're listening to data compressed audio files, which are also lacking in dynamic range. Ironically, when we make an MP3 out of a file that has a more natural dynamic range, it sounds better. MP3 is actually optimized for more natural sounding recordings. It will make a dynamic recording sound better than an over compressed recording.
Mm-hmm.
And most audiophiles know the oldest trick in the book if you're doing A-B tests between two different recordings. If you turn one recording up louder, like just a half a dB, maybe less, maybe even 0.2 decibels, and then you do a blind listening between two exactly the same recordings, but one is just a fraction louder, everybody in the room will say, oh, that one sounds better. What did you do? It sounds like a better soundstage. Is that better cables? Is it better clocking? Better converters? No, it's just a tiny, tiny, tiny bit louder. And so this is this slippery slope that happens, because when something is louder, it sounds flatter to our ears. It sounds, you know, more balanced in frequencies. And we can hear better into the depth of the recording. Mm. So as we start turning these digital recordings up louder and louder, we run up against the ceiling, and we now have these very advanced tools that do look-ahead limiting that chop off the peaks and make it sound so that the peaks are at the same level as the average. And that works up to a point when you start chopping off the average signal. The body of the wave starts becoming a rectangle, a square wave. And this is when we start getting severe distortion. Any transient that's longer than about 2 or 3 milliseconds is audible when it's compressed. If we can actually compress or limit transients that are less than maybe 5 milliseconds without noticing it, without hearing it.
We're talking about things like the beginnings of drum hits and that sort of thing.
Exactly, exactly. You know, the beginning of an acoustic guitar pluck. Yeah, these short, sharp transients. And you can get things louder up to a point using these tools by clipping off these little tiny transients. But as soon as we start cutting into the body of the sound, it becomes a distortion. And most mastering engineers that I know of are suspicious that this tendency to make things louder and louder and push the audio signal up against the ceiling, up against the digital ceiling, that this tendency is causing people to listen less and less often to the same recordings. What happens is when we buy a new album, or let's say bootleg the new album, or whatever form of download or, you know, consumption we choose, the novelty of that music makes it interesting to us for the first few listens. And then as soon as the novelty wears off, the texture of the music, it becomes interesting. Sorry, that little flash of light turning dark there is my screen going blank for a screensaver.
Oh. Yeah, right. And
push my little cursor up to the top so we don't have a screensaver problem. The novelty wears off and the fatigue factor starts setting in. And so the music is far less enjoyable. It's less tactily, you know, seductive. I like this word seduction. I think this is what we're really doing as recording artists or as composers and as a mastering engineer. I'm really trying to seduce the listener. I'm trying to create an interchange with the listener, an exchange of energy. For me, the metaphors are active. They're active metaphors. They're not these passive metaphors of consumption. I don't want to entertain the listener. I want to actually bring them into my world, you know, metaphorically take them to bed. It's something that requires a different approach to the audio, something that is a little more gentle, a little more requesting of the listener something a little more patient, so that we're not just confronting them with new noise, but rather I want to seduce them with gorgeous textures.
Mm. This is a fascinating discussion and ideas that you're presenting here. And something came up in my mind as you were talking about depth that I'd like to get to in just a moment. But if you can hang on for a second, I'd like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing your website or blog, and it's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. There are hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of them to fill your needs. Squarespace all-inclusive service includes several modules to build your website, such as a blog module, forum, a form builder, Flickr photo display, Twitter widget, Google Maps, and more. Website tracking and built-in search engine optimizer helps you keep track of who's coming to your site. There's permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability, an innovative drag-and-drop Ajax interface, even an iPhone app to log into your website from wherever you are and update it on the go. Use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime. For a 14-day free trial, go to squarespace.com/HTG. Sign up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just try it out to build your website. That's squarespace.com/HTG. So, Robert, when you were talking about depth earlier and how audiophiles really are looking for that, and my question to you is, they're looking for that with two speakers. What about surround? What about music in surround? We've seen this now try to get off the ground for a long time with SACD, DVD audio, not so much with downloaded music. Why hasn't it been more successful? Well, there certainly is more sense of depth in surround recordings than in two-channel, isn't there?
I love surround myself. I think that it's especially well-suited to the kind of music I'm known for, which is a more atmospheric, spacious kind of music. To be able to create a kind of synthetic universe where instruments are coming from everywhere, you know, with my music, because it's more abstract, there's not really a need for this sense that there's a bunch of musicians in front of you on a stage and that you're in the audience. I think it's possible to create a completely rich environment of complete sonic immersion.
I agree with you. A lot of people prefer the audience perspective, as it's sometimes called, but I really like to be completely immersed in the sound of the music. So I'm with you on that.
Well, and it depends stylistically on the music. I mean, if I'm listening to a live recording, it can be really annoying to hear, you know, the keyboards coming from the left rear speaker. I think the problem with adoption is one of social engineering and one of, you know, nobody's come up with the killer app yet, except for perhaps film. You know, if you think of the way that most people's listening rooms are set up, if there's multimedia involved, and if there's 5.1 surround involved, it's centered around a screen and it's centered around vision, image. As I mentioned, so many of my students are getting into music because they want to make music for film or music for games. The music is subservient to image in this case. Now, when we're talking about music for film, well, then a lot of people are listening to music right now in surround on Blu-ray or DVD. We could argue that many people aren't setting up their home theaters very well or whatever. It's difficult to find the space in a room, you know, to put the speakers in the right spots. Our living room certainly doesn't lend itself to that. I think that when we're talking in a more purist sense of the listening experience of music in surround without image, then we have this problem of getting people to stay in the same place for a period of time. We have the problem of how do we distribute music to people without image attached. I faced this in 1999 when I was working on my DVD Somnium. It was a DVD V format, video format, and I had to have a video frame with every audio frame, but I wanted 7 hours of audio. And the problem was that the video frame, even if it was compressed down to one pixel, still took more data than the audio did.
Really?
And it created a real problem trying to fit the audio onto a DVD. We ended up having to do stuff that made it impossible to fast forward because basically there's no synchronized video frame with the audio. It was a technical problem, and I still feel that the DVD release was a compromise. Now, that was a two-channel stereo recording. I wanted it to be completely uncompressed because AAC Dolby compression didn't sound good with this very ambient music. Mm-hmm. Skip ahead, 2006, I released a video in surround called Atlas Day. And let's see, I even have it looks like this, if anybody's interested. Let's see, I'll stick it on the camera there.
That's a DVD?
It's a DVD. Yeah, let me see. I have to, I'm having trouble with the left and right frames. Anyway, that wasn't too happy. It doesn't look very good. Sorry.
Anyway, give it the name again. Atlas Day.
D-E-I. Yeah, like Map of God. And a nice presumptuous title. I apologize, but it sounded good.
That's 90 minutes of music in surround, is it not?
It's completely 90 minutes of music with motion graphics by Dan Colvin. And it was a way to get my music in surround because people just need something to look at. It's a little bit of a strong plate of meat if you think of, you know, the 90 minutes of abstract motion graphic visuals. However, it was just a way to get people to understand that this was an album, you know, that this was music. I just finished mixing, well, I say just, my goodness, it was almost 2 years ago, mixing a surround composition by Marcus Reuter called Todd Morton 513. And the just part of that came out because he just released it on CD, the stereo mix that I did for him. It's a rather pretty intense modern classical piece that's a continuous 1 hour long piece of music. He sent me, it was somewhere around 80 tracks of electronic and acoustic ensemble recording, and it took me about a month to mix it in surround. It was a massive undertaking, and he still hasn't really found the way to distribute that surround mix. It's a gorgeous recording. The stereo version sounds great, I think, but the problem is that the distribution potential for a piece of classical music that's an hour long continuous piece of music in surround is just not, I don't know. It's just, the problem is one of concept. If you think of the way Apple succeeded with iTunes, the way they made that work was they created a piece of hardware that integrated seamlessly with a purchasing environment, a piece of software that was hooked up directly to your computer, and the whole thing worked seamlessly. The convenience factor got people to consume more music than in recent history. It really was it's that tech term, killer app. What right. made it so good was that the hardware integrated with the software, and it created an environment that made it convenient and easy for people.
Let me thank our other sponsor for this episode, MailRoute. Businesses of every size use MailRoute. One user, 50,000 users, doesn't matter. MailRoute will protect you from spam and viruses, simplify your life, and make your email usable again. I could use that. MailRoute is a secure hosted service that filters viruses and spam from companies of any size. It eliminates viruses and spam, reduces the load on your email server, lowers your costs,
and post-show.
And makes your email usable again.
It takes like 5 minutes for it to get connected.
Typical MailRoute customers see a 95% reduction in their inbound email volume with virtually no false positives. Leo Laporte uses MailRoute, and he loves it. He's been using the service for his domains for more than 6 years.
Take your phone.
Tom Merritt started using MailRoute, and he can now use email domains that he's given up on as hopeless. There's no hardware or software to install. You just sign up with MailRoute and then change the MX records for your domain to start your mail flowing through them, and they do all the rest. Visit MailRoute.info to sign up. As a Twit listener, you'll receive 10% discount for the life of your account. Small business accounts start at $2 per user per month for 10 users. And because of demand from the Twit Army, MailRoute has added a new service for individual users at less than $30 per year. Visit MailRoute.info and sign up with the email filtering that Tom and Leo both use. So how are we doing there, John?
We're back.
We're back. Yay. Hey, Robert. I don't know what happened there.
It seems as if my DSL line slowed way down. I mean, I don't know what's going on, but it seems from what I'm seeing that the data rate's pretty slow right now.
Yeah. Well, we don't have too much longer to go here, so hopefully it'll hang in. we're talking about distribution and how Apple with iTunes developed a killer app for music distribution by wedding the software with the purchasing, and we don't really have anything like that for multi-channel yet. I don't even know if iTunes does have a multi-channel option. Do you?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, well, technically, no, there is one right now. However, the problem is that if mobile listening is really the standard for people to listen to music, how are they going to make sense out of that in a surround context? I don't think anybody's come up with, I don't think anybody's come up with surround headphones that really convey the experience of music all around you. There are some attempts to create headphones.
I was going to ask exactly that. There are some technologies that attempt to simulate surround within headphones. Dolby headphone is probably the most common example, and I've heard it, and it's not bad.
That's a possibility. I think that something like a Dolby headphone could work. The challenge is that in real surround, there's speakers that will be stable when you move your head. So you hear the music in a fixed position, even though you are in a mobile position. Whereas with mobile listening, the music turns with you. And I'm not sure how important that would be for the surround experience to get the sense of you in a space. If you're moving your head and the space doesn't
moves
move with you.
Actually, have you heard of Smith Research Realizer? This is a surround simulator in headphones, and it includes a head tracker that basically you have to mount this little gizmo on your headphones, and then as you move around, it changes the algorithm so that it appears as though the surround speakers, quote unquote, the virtual surround speakers, do not move. It's a wonderful situation, but it's very expensive and wouldn't be well appropriate for mobile applications.
I think that some technology like this would have to be the solution for making surround audio a mobile possibility. But also somebody has to integrate it with a purchasing system, or at least a consumption system that somehow works. And whether there would be an infrastructure in place for that, I'm just not sure. Until that happens, I don't really see surround becoming a standard.
Musical format.
Yeah, a standard musical format. It's a good standard video format. And as long as there's a picture to keep people in place, in one spot looking forward. But it is that social structuring of the experience that people are going to stay in one place looking in front of them, and the music will surround them. And most people these days, when they listen to music, are used to moving around, and they're not going to be in a sweet spot.
Mm-hmm. Afraid so. Let's talk for a moment about some of your projects. I've been always very fascinated, for example, with your live performances that are called sleep concerts, which I believe the Somnium DVD, which we talked about a little earlier, comes out of. What's the whole idea behind these sleep concerts?
Well, it started back when I was a freshman in college in 1981. I was looking at ways of creating an environment to expose people to the kind of sound that I was interested in, which was extremely long duration, trance-inducing, hypnotic drones and environments. I wanted to try to create a virtual environment for people, and was trying to solve a few things that I felt to be shortcomings in our culture, actually. One is that I felt that we didn't have much of a communal way of experiencing music. If you look at more traditional cultures, such as, in Indonesia, where they will listen for days on end to the wayang reenactments of the Ramayana, or, for example, the healing rituals of ancient Mesoamerica, or even current, in Aboriginal people in Australia and such, I felt that music was incorrectly turning into a solitary experience, and that the communal aspects of music were harder and harder to obtain, especially outside of a sort of rock concert venue where I think the more Dionysian aspects of music are played out.
Good point.
I wanted to find a way of creating a communal trance environment, a sort of alternate ritual space. And it was something that we had no cultural context for. So the only way to do that is to create a sort of art context to make an artificial, well, it's funny, the word arc and artificial have the same root to them, don't they?
Never thought of that before, but you're right.
To manufacture something, you know, to manufacture an experience and apply certain possibilities to the people coming to experience it. And I thought the only way to get people to stay in one place for long enough is to invite them to sleep, because otherwise people have a very short attention span. And I think that's truer now than it was in 1982 when I did the first sleep concert. This problem of getting anybody to do the same thing for more than 20 minutes, it's a challenge. Yeah. And so I thought, well, when do people actually stay in one place for 6 to 8 to 10 hours? Well, it's when they're sleeping. So I decided to use that as a sort of ruse, a little bit of a trick in a way, to get people to come and experience something for an extended period of time. People obviously assumed that it meant that the music was supposed to make them fall asleep. And it's not really that. It's actually meant to be conducive to altered states of experience in those nether regions between waking and sleep, what sleep people, researchers call hypnagogic and hypnopompic imagery, these things that happen when you're out of sleep, right? Surfing along the edge. I liken it to a rock skimming along the surface of a lake, where you're not quite under and you're not quite on top. You're just on the edge. And by encouraging people to bring a sleeping bag and a pillow, I could kind of trick them into being in this environment for longer than otherwise they would think to be.
Now,
and I would usually give a little...
I'm sorry, go right ahead.
Go ahead.
I would usually
give a little talk concert to sort of educate them on what my intentions were and hope that it would create experience.
But if they actually did fall asleep, what is your expectation of their being able to perceive? I mean, do you think that your music would enter their dreams, perhaps?
Oh, it did to a certain extent. I mean, people would report the next morning on things that they experienced in their dreams. Obviously, people do fall asleep and then they wake up. It's a disturbed sleep that they have in this communal environment. Remember, it's going to be, you know, 20 to 30, 40 strangers sharing a room together, which is also a very strange thing for people in our culture. In any culture, for that matter, because if people in a village are sleeping together, they almost certainly know everybody that they're sharing this space with. Whereas in our culture, we are a culture of strangers. And more so now that we live isolated with the internet creating an illusion of community, I think that there's something missing. I think that when we bring people actually together in a physical space, something different happens. Physiologically, people's body gears up a little bit. Heart rate rises. People don't sleep as deeply. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting to me.
Very.
That sheer physiological increase of metabolism make people sleep less deeply, but people certainly do fall in and out of sleep, and you'll get the inevitable round of snoring throughout the night.
Becomes part of the piece, right?
Oh, it does. In fact, I mean, 20% of the population snores, and so you're certainly going to get a lot of that.
I do have one last question for you from the chat room. Beatmaster asks, "What is your monitoring gear? What speakers and amps and so on do you use for monitoring while you're composing, mastering, and so on?"
Well, I'm mixing and composing on the same speakers that I master with, which are Tech Sovereigns. A little bit of an over the top kind of thing. If I could turn the screen here around, I could probably show you, but I'm not sure if it would work.
No,
it's a little
that's okay.
bit difficult to turn this screen. But yeah, so. Duntech Sovereigns are made by John Dunlavy, who passed away a couple of years ago. And they were the Australian version of the speaker that became the Dunlavy SC5. It was actually designed with the help of Bob Ludwig. And they were his mastering monitors, not mine, weren't specifically Bob Ludwig's mastering monitors, but the same design, until Ludwig changed his, I think, about 5-6 years ago. Mm-hmm. For my surround system, I'm using Dunlavy SC2s, which match very well to the mains. So I had mixed Atlas Day in Dynaudio BM5As, but I didn't like the sound that they were coming from a small box. So I realized that the only way I'd really be satisfied was to integrate a surround system with the mains. And so I found some used pairs of Dunleavy SC2s, which are a Dappolito two-way passive speaker. They're similar to the big mains, except they are small. Let's see. I might even be able to see if I tip this like that. Maybe you can see. Yeah, there's one of them in the distance.
Right. So, next to that nice big modular synthesizer.
That's right. So that black tower with the frequency counter sitting on top of it is a Dunleavy SC2. I've got three of those in the center and the two rears, and I'll rotate this back now. Yep. So,
great. Well, so thank you for answering that question. And with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, Robert Rich, for an extremely insightful conversation, and hope to have you back sometime. Thanks, Robert.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's great to see you again.
And you. You can check out Robert's website at robertrich.com, and where there's photos of his concerts and lots of information there. Very interesting stuff. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Scott Ross, a pioneer in digital media who was general manager of Lucasfilm ILM in the 1980s and founded the digital effects studio Digital Domain with James Cameron and Stan Winston. So that should be an extremely interesting conversation that I sure hope you'll join me for. Until then, geek out.